At one time or another, people have tried to twist or change virtually every fact and story that we find in the Bible. One example of this is found in John 2, today's text. You may remember that it is in the second chapter of John that we read about Jesus' first miracle. The Lord came to a place that was in the upper section of Israel. This place was known as Cana of Galilee. The Bible tells us in the second chapter of John that Jesus and his disciples had been invited to a wedding feast in this community. You may remember that the people involved in this activity ran short on at least one of their supplies. The beverage that was being served ran out, and Jesus was called on to offer some assistance. You may not know this, but there is a well-known religious group that claims that the wedding in John 2 was actually Jesus' wedding. This religious group says that Jesus was the one getting married. It describes his taking a Jewish bride. Well, that's not true. John 2:2 says that the Lord was bidden to this feast, and that means that he was a guest. He was not a participant. The Bible never says anything about Jesus getting married or Jesus having a wife. If we are at least somewhat familiar with the information in this chapter, we may remember, we probably know, that Jesus turned, quote-unquote, water into wine. There are a lot of interesting things about this particular miracle, and today we want to kind of offer a general study of what's in here and then make some practical points of application. We will begin with what is perhaps the item that is most frequently studied or wondered about when people read this information. The word wine occurs early in John 2. It's found in verse 3. In John 2:3, the Bible says, "The wine failed." Now, this verse tells us that the people who were attending this particular wedding feast had access to, and they were apparently drinking a liquid which is described as wine. Then as we look at John 2 verse 9, we find that Jesus took some water, and he turned this water into wine. Now, most of the people that I talk to about this particular account say, well, look, the word wine is used in John 2, and we know what wine is. Wine is an alcoholic drink, therefore we believe, we claim that Jesus turned wine into an alcoholic beverage. For first point, we'll want to do a little research on the word wine as it is used in the scriptures. There are a couple of passages that I think as we look at these verses, it will reveal that the Bible uses this word in a way that we may not think. These verses are verses that we should not only know, but they're verses that we should know well. Both of these verses come from the book of Isaiah. And if you have the sheet, you may have already turned back to Isaiah 16. And then after we look at the 16th chapter of Isaiah, we're going to shortly, after that, turn over to Isaiah chapter 65. Now, in both Isaiah 16 and Isaiah 65, we find that God's prophet uses the word wine. I'm going to read two verses, one from Isaiah 16, one from Isaiah 65. But as I read these verses, I'm going to change the text. Instead of using the word wine as it appears in the text, I'm going to substitute the words alcoholic beverage. And the reason that I'm going to do that is to help us see the point that's made. All right, I think most have turned over to Isaiah 16, verse 10. Let's look at it. "And gladness is taken away, and joy out of the fruitful field. And in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither joyful noise, nor treader," that would be the treader of the grapes, "nor treader shall tread out alcoholic wine in the presses." Now, the information and the imagery in Isaiah 16 is not difficult. Isaiah gives us a picture which we can imagine. It is time to harvest grapes. And as we prepare for this grape harvest, we take our grapes, we put them into a large container, and we begin to squeeze those freshly picked grapes to force out the juice. Now, if we were to do that, we've got this bunch of grapes and we bring them in a container and we start squeezing them, that juice that comes from the grape, what is that juice going to be? Is that juice going to be grape juice? Or is that product from the grape going to be wine? Well, the answer is grape juice and not wine. If you've never done that, you've probably gone to the store and bought a bunch of grapes. Take a grape from the bunch and bite into it. What is it as far as the juice? Is it grape juice or is it wine? Well, everybody would say, we know it's grape juice. We've had that particular experience. Isaiah in Isaiah 16:10 talks about putting grapes and squeezing them and says the product that results from the squeezing, what we're getting from those crushed grapes, it's not what? Wine in the sense of an alcoholic product. It is wine in the sense of grape juice. Isaiah 16:10 uses the word wine to describe not an alcoholic beverage, but grape juice. If we had no other verse than Isaiah 16:10, that would be enough to show us that the word wine, it certainly could describe an alcoholic beverage. But Isaiah 16:10 also shows us that the word wine is broad enough. It is inclusive enough to also describe freshly squeezed grape juice. Now, we would not need any other passage, but as I said, in addition to Isaiah chapter 16, we have some information towards the end of the book. Isaiah chapter 65. The verse that we want from the 65th chapter is the information in verse 8. Isaiah does a similar thing here. Isaiah 65, verse 8. Thus saith Jehovah, as the alcoholic beverage is found in the cluster. Oh, no, that can't be right. In the cluster of the grape, as that grape is hanging on the vine, there's alcohol in it. Not literally. That's not really true. It's grape juice at that particular point. And this passage also tells us that when we see this word wine, we have to stop and ask, are we dealing with an alcoholic product? Or is this word being used in that broader sense where it describes simply the grape juice, the juice in the grape? Well, since we know that the word wine is broad enough to describe both, when we come to John 2 and we find that Jesus changed water into wine, what does that wine mean? Is it the product of the grape juice, or is it an alcoholic beverage? Now, there are a lot of people who, as they look at this particular account, they say, well, it's got to be an alcoholic beverage. Well, how do you know that? Especially based on the information in Isaiah. All right, as we look from John 2, we have, I think, some indications that help us understand what exactly Jesus made. Notice from John 2, verse 6, how much water was used when Jesus took this product and turned it into wine. The sixth verse says, now there were six water pots of stone set there after the Jews' manner of purifying. Containers, two or three firkins apiece. Now, a firkin was about nine gallons. If you round that up, we're dealing with pots that were about 10 gallons each. And since these pots held two to three firkins, we're dealing with pots that would have held between 20 and 30 gallons each. Now, we know that there were six of these, so when you begin to do the math, there were about 150 gallons of water. Now, as you look at verse 7 in this account, the Bible says these pots were filled to the brim, so they were completely full. So now we've got, once again, a product that is being formed from about 150 gallons of water. Now, that is a lot of water. Imagine 150 gallons of milk stacked one right after the other. I was curious what this would come out to as far as the actual weight in pounds. So I went back and did some looking. 150 gallons of water is well over 1,000 pounds. Under 1,500 pounds, but you know, around 1,200 pounds roughly. So if Jesus made 150 gallons of alcohol, he made a lot of booze. I mean, we're talking about a lot of liquor if this is an alcoholic beverage. Now, some are absolutely persuaded, and I've had people just absolutely insist over the years that Jesus made an alcoholic product on this occasion. But I'll tell you, I am absolutely puzzled by that interpretation for a few reasons. Number one, in Matthew 11, verse 19, a little later in Jesus' public ministry, the Lord is charged with being a wine bibber. He is, at a later time, accused of somebody who likes the bottle. He is charged at a later time in his public ministry with excessive wine consumption. Jesus, you are someone who likes liquor. You like wine. Now, had I lived in the first century, and had I wanted to oppose the Lord, and there were a lot of people who wanted to oppose Jesus on just one account or one ground successfully, I can tell you what I would have argued. If I had been a Jew hostile to the Lord, I would have argued, hey, there was a wedding feast some time ago. It was in Cana of Galilee. It was a wedding feast where people had come and they had, you know, they drank so much that they drank up everything that was there. And then Jesus came along. Jesus of Nazareth showed up. And Jesus performed a sign. Jesus of Nazareth made alcohol. And he made alcohol for a crowd of people. And I want you to know that this Jesus who came along and made the liquor, he didn't make a few pints. He didn't make a few quarts. He didn't make a few gallons for people to drink. The Jesus who was called the Christ made 150 gallons of alcohol. More than 1,000 pounds of booze was made by the one that you want to honor. What kind of man of God makes free booze for people that totals more than 1,000 pounds of alcohol? What servant of God makes more than 150 gallons of liquor for people who have already been drinking for a while? Now, we do not know how many people were at the feast at Cana of Galilee. I wish I had that information, but the Bible's silent on that point. But we do know this. When you begin to look at how much Jesus made, if there had been 2,400 people at this feast, it would have been, Jesus would have made enough to give every individual, 2,400 people, a pint of the wine described in John 2. Now, if you can't imagine how much a pint is offhand, think about a carton of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. That's a pint. 2,400 people could have had that much to drink. If the wedding had less than 200 people, and I think that's probably a reasonable possibility because, once again, this is a small, small place. Then Jesus made enough of this product so every person could have a gallon of his quote-unquote wine. If this wine were an intoxicating substance, I cannot imagine for the life of me why his opponents did not charge him with sin later in life. Think about our time today. Is it not true that when someone loads up an individual or a group with alcohol, that criminal charges are often involved? It happens. Imagine what authorities would do to someone who brings to a group of people 150 gallons of alcohol, even if it were a low-grade product, low-grade liquor. The Jews look high and low. They searched and searched and searched to find something as far as some kind of fault within Jesus. But not one time do we ever find them going back to his first miracle in John chapter 2. Why not? Jesus was called a wine bibber, Matthew 11, verse 19. But why not go back and build that on the information in John chapter 2? Why do the people omit that when we read about the persecution? Why would the Lord begin his ministry with a miracle that would later open him up to the kind of allegation that we read about in Matthew 11? Grape juice, as we saw from Isaiah 16. And Isaiah 65 is certainly involved in the word wine. That has to be a possibility when you look at the word. And I think most people would say that grape juice is tasty. It's bottled today and people will pay a fair price for it. There's no reason that grape juice was not, could not have been used at this particular wedding feast. Now, some claim that the wine in the first century was diluted. And I have no problem with that. I think that's probably true. Because of the culture, bad water and some other things, it seems that water was mixed with wine. And by our standards, the product that was produced probably would have been either sub-alcoholic or a non-alcoholic beverage. But that still does not eliminate the fact that the Bible sometimes uses the word wine to describe grape juice. Jesus made a product that was superb. It's commended in John 2. And it was a product that did not allow people to later charge him with sin. All right, since we've covered one of the most basic questions about this account, let's focus on some other things. In John 2, we see that Jesus is someone who believed in living in the world where he existed. Some have the idea that Christians should just hide from the world, not be part of the environment that they're in. But that was not how the Lord looked at life. He was someone who participated in the things of this life just as we should. Jesus' mother was at the wedding feast that took place in Cana. Some think that she was a helper. That's certainly a possibility. And when Jesus was invited to this particular wedding feast, he accepted the invitation, verse 2. If we are going to be people who want to make an impact in our world for Christ, we also, on some level, need to be involved with our world. That means that Christian parents can be and should be involved in the schools where their children attend. It means that we shouldn't be involved in the things in our workplace and in our neighborhoods. And when we're involved, people need to know who we are. Yes, we're willing to volunteer. Yes, we're willing to help. Yes, we're willing to assist, but we're doing that in part because we're a Christian. We're a child of God. We want to be a good influence. We want to be a light in our world. Our society will often take help wherever it comes from. If people want to volunteer, oh, yes, we'll take your effort. We'll take your time. We'll take your money. It's rare that people will turn down free volunteers. But being willing to help is just part of what we should do. We, as we help, need to let people know there is a reason why we're helping. And that reason is that we are a follower of Christ. We are a Christian. Jesus did not try to hide that fact as he aided people, and neither should we. The world needs to see our faith in God as well as our commitment to him. Jesus lived in this way, as did his mother Mary. Jesus' mother Mary knew that the supply of wine had been exhausted. John 2, verse 3. Mary believed in God. She wanted to serve God, and she was willing to help others. Her help on this occasion may be a lot more significant than we've thought in the past. Suppose this next week, next weekend, next Friday, next Saturday, maybe next Sunday afternoon, there's a couple that we know. And that couple is going to be married, let's say, next Saturday. And we go to the wedding, and then, of course, we show up to the reception afterwards. As we're standing there in the reception line, word is passed, we become aware of the fact that either the food is gone, it's all been eaten, they didn't bring enough, or the punch is all gone. And now, even though we're in the line to get something to eat and drink, everything has been taken by others. Now, we can stay and visit, but there's not going to be any food, there's not going to be anything to drink. Can we imagine someone who is in that reception line, and they do not get anything to eat and drink, and they say, we're going to sue the bride and groom. We were in the line, and we didn't get to participate in this part of the meal, and we're going to sue them. Well, maybe that's not so crazy in our culture today. There's probably some lawyer that would do that. But for the most part, if we're friends, we're going to say there's no way that we would sue them. There is some information where people in the first century were allowed and presumably did sue people, the bride and the groom. If you showed up for a wedding and they didn't have enough food and drink, people initiated a lawsuit. Wow. So when the Bible tells us that Mary notified Jesus that the beverage was gone, this was a big, big deal. Possibly could open up the couple to litigation. Even if the couple was not sued, imagine the embarrassment. Cana of Galilee was a small place. And had this couple run out of at least one item, maybe food, some other things, I guess, could have also been diminished to the point where they didn't have enough to serve, it would have been an event that would have been remembered for many, many years. Some people needed help, and Jesus came to the rescue. This provides us with another important lesson in life. When the call for assistance goes out, when people need something, do we rise to the occasion like the Lord did? When a neighbor needs help, do we rise up and say we're ready to assist? If it's children or grandchildren, they say we need assistance, do we help? How available are we? When our local congregation issues a call for workers and assistance, how often and how quickly do we respond? Jesus responded, and he responded in a powerful and forceful way. We've noted that the product that he provided was approximately 150 gallons. Jesus made enough drink to take care of almost 2,500 people. And since this was a small community, since the people had already been drinking something for a time, there was probably a lot of leftovers. It's been proposed that Jesus gave this couple a wedding gift through the product that he made, and that very well could be true. Jesus helped, and his help was truly noteworthy. When we seek to help people in life, do we try to go above and beyond? That's what Jesus did. Do we give others the best that we can, or do we simply try to get by? That's not what we see in John 2. Jesus' example tells us that we want to do the very best that we can. Another key lesson is found in John 2, verse 5. Mary told these servants, you do whatever he tells you. Now, I like to think about that because filling water pots full of water probably didn't make a lot of sense to these men. Well, why does he want us to do that? They're thirsty. Perhaps as they were filling those pots, they smiled, they laughed, they joked, maybe gave a wink to one another. If they acted in that way, the joke was on them. When deity tells man to do something, when deity issues an instruction, there's always a reason for it. God is still telling us things today to do through his word. In some cases, maybe there are certain instructions that may not always make the most sense to us, but we need to listen to what he has to say and do it. God has proven time and time again that his instructions are right and essential, so our job is to hear and obey. That obedience, of course, needs to be in all things. Then in verse 11, we find a reference to belief. When the Lord's disciples began to see what Jesus could do, they were willing to believe, and they did believe. Well, today, we're not with Jesus. We don't see those kinds of miracles, but we've got the book. The book that tells us about this miracles, the other signs, and this book is the source that we use to believe. God not only wants us to believe in him, but he wants us to believe in him to the point where we also obey. And that's where we close this morning. Are we people who not only believe, but we're people who obey? The Bible talks about the need to believe. The Bible talks about the need to turn from sin, repentance. That's part of being obedient. It talks about the need to confess Christ as Lord, Romans 10, 9 and 10. And that obedience culminates with being baptized into Christ, Galatians 3, 27. So every single sin can be washed away. If the Lord had the power to turn water into wine, John 2, he's got the power to forgive every single sin. We hope that you've been obedient to him and you've had that blessing in your life. We also hope because of who he is, you're continuing to live a life that's pleasing to him by following his word every single day. The one who turned the water into wine is going to come again. All people will stand before him in judgment. Those who are righteous taken to a great place of eternal rest and peace. Those who are not, into a place of indescribable anguish. We're all going to see him one day. Do we believe in the sense that we've obeyed and are continuing to obey so we can be with him forever and ever? That's the question that we have to answer. It's going to be a question that we think about as we stand and sing. And if you're not in the right relationship with him, will you not decide today to write things so that you can be on the right side of the Lord? If we can help you alter your relationship with God in the way that you need to do, let us know as we stand and sing the selected song.
There's a soul wandering from the fold.